So it seems like electric vehicles are having a very, very terrible time in the last several months, and it just seems to be getting worse. There is a report that we're going to be talking about that shows that maybe electric vehicles are even worse for pollution than internal combustion engines. How could that possibly be? We're going to be taking a look at that. Also, eco-terrorists taking aim at Tesla. Yep, that is also happening in this clown world that we live in. We're going to be talking about all this and more on episode 439 of the In the Tank podcast. Good afternoon, all. Welcome to the In the Tank podcast. As always, I am your host, Donald Kendall. Joining me for this episode, I've got Jim Lakely, VP of the Heartland Institute. How are you doing today, good sir?
I'm doing just fine, enjoying a work from home day remote on a nice cool spring day. I guess it's not really officially spring yet here in Chicago, but the weather sure is nice. And I am looking forward to ignoring the State of the Union address tonight. So
yes,
that's on my agenda.
I think the vast majority of the country will. Working from home, am I right, guys? Millennials. Also joining us, we've got Chris Telgo, editorial director here at the Heartland Institute. How are you doing today, working from inside the office?
I'm holding down the fort here at Heartland headquarters in Arlington Heights at an undisclosed location. And that's all.
You just disclosed it,
you dummy.
Well, did I give the address, everybody? No. Arlington Heights is a very large tract of land, and I would challenge anyone to immediately put two and two together as to where we're exactly located by the angle of the sun coming into Donnie's office. So
boomers, am I right, Jim?
Yeah, right.
Gosh, yep. Yes.
and the fact that our address is on our website, so but you know, whatever.
Don't dox us, bro. All right, before we get going into any of these topics, I have to put that message out there to all of our audio-only listeners. They're catching the show probably on a Friday or later. Leave a review for us on iTunes. That'd be greatly appreciated. You could also join us a day earlier on Thursdays at noon Central Time, where we are live streaming this on Facebook and YouTube and X and Rumble. You can join the conversation, throw your comments and questions in the chat. Maybe we'll show your comment on the screen. Maybe we'll address your questions on the fly. Super chat functionality is enabled if you want to support the show that way, or if you just want to support the show by spending a couple of seconds. All you have to do is hit that like button, share this content, subscribe if you haven't already, or leave a comment under the video. All helps break through those big tech algorithms and prevent content like this from being shown to more people. Welcome, everyone. I see Doug Troyer in the stream there, engineer guy. I see Abel Windsor. Where's all our normal people? Chime in. Let me know you're here. Looking forward to seeing your comments throughout the show. But gentlemen, this week was Super Tuesday. Oh my gosh, guys, how were you glued to your TV? Were you just waiting for all the different results to trickle in? I mean, it's one of the biggest election nights of the, you know, the primary. How excited were you? How focused in were you on this this year, Jim?
I almost forgot it took place and that it was taking place because this is the most boring, you know, political primary season in my lifetime. You know, I remember as a young man and even as a teenager, you know, following these things pretty closely. It was always a lot more fun when there's a ton of candidates out there, like it was in 2016. I think we had a record number of Republicans running for president, and of course, Trump won that going away. But yeah, as I've remarked, you and I both had this problem on Wednesday morning, Donnie, is that we went to some of the world's most trafficked news sites, like the New York Times and CNN and Fox News and the Wall Street Journal, looking for a map, an interactive map, which is standard election coverage stuff, so that I could just see, oh, you know, I'm slightly curious to see how well he did in Tennessee or one of the other Super Tuesday states. And I couldn't find anything. It's like our mainstream media is not that interested in covering politics right now either, except to warn that all their coverage is just warning how fascism is coming. That's all warnings. And, you know, I know Chris is our resident MSNBC and CNN watcher, but I heard and I saw clips on X that MSNBC was a bit of a poop show on election night.
Yeah, no, seriously, I was going throughout because I wanted to see the map too. And like the best websites that I could find, the one that I was looking at was Politico. And that one only showed like, here's the more important states. I'm just like, I just want to see them all. Can't I just see them all? But it seemed like nobody cared. It was barely even trending on Twitter. Like it was just, it's just like so past the expectation that Trump is obviously going to win that like literally nobody cares. Chris, what was going down on these other cable news stations?
Well, Danny, you know, I called it Superfluous Tuesday and I should have trademarked that, damn it. Okay. So I did watch MSNBC and CNN and Fox News on Tuesday evening because I am a dedicated cable TV news viewer and because I work 24/7, which Jim should know by now. Okay. So in here's what I took away. MSNBC and CNN, what they were doing was they were showing the state-by-state races. However, they were trying to make it seem as if Nikki Haley got a large portion of Republican votes. But anyone with half a brain knows that, wait a second, most of these were open primaries, which meant that a lot of Democratic voters were voting for Haley. So when they were trying to make it sound like, oh my gosh, Donald Trump has no way of winning the election because 30%, 40% of Republicans would never vote for him. That's not true because most of those were actually Democrats who were voting in open primaries. And it was so funny and it was so interesting that they failed to mention that in several states, Joe Biden received 80%, which meant that 20% were going to uncommitted voter or Marianne Williamson or other people. And this was to me the best part of the evening. In American Samoa, a businessman from Baltimore actually beat Joe Biden. So I think that is the canary in the coal mine for the 2024 election. And I think that if things keep going as they are, we are going to see a landslide, guys. It is going to be a 1980 Reagan landslide. I mean, 49 states are going to go red. I'm thinking we can put California in there, New York, Illinois.
It's always considered American Samoa as the bellwether of how the upcoming elections is going to go.
Well,
so
it is. But I mean, in all like seriousness, what I am trying to say is they were doing their best to make it seem like, okay, Trump is the GOP nominee, but he has no way of winning. So they were already, I think, uncovering their strategy to make it seem as if Trump has no shot at winning in 2024, because I think that really deep down, they are scared out of their minds. Because if you look at the polls, whether it's the New York Times poll, which shows that Trump would beat Biden in a head-to-head matchup right now, this is like unprecedented territory. Another couple other polls that I saw that were being mentioned by Fox, because Fox did provide, I think, some pretty compelling insights. 10% of Joe Biden's voters said that they would not only not vote for Joe Biden in 2024, but they will switch and vote for Trump. That's 8 million votes right there. Mm-hmm. Now, the percentage of Trump voters who said that they would not vote for Trump and would vote for Joe Biden was zero. So I don't understand how, you know, because they constantly say,
John Kasich.
Well, but here's the thing. They constantly keep saying that the GOP is so divided and there's, you know, all this turmoil between the never Trumpers and Haley and her voters and all this stuff. But that is not the case because, you know, like we said earlier, many of those were open primaries, which meant that Democrats were going and trying to make it look as if Trump did not have a stronghold over those, you know, states. But in reality, he did, because he got like 75% in Texas. He got like 80% in North Carolina. So I think that this, you know, is very good news for Trump supporters, because I think that come general election time, they are going to come out in, you know, in just in swamp the polls.
Yeah, it seemed like there was a lot of takeaways of, oh, Nikki Haley didn't endorse Trump in her concession speech and all this different stuff. And, whoa, you know, is she going to run as some independent thing? Like, no, it's not going to happen. But even the New York Times, when they had this article that was like the five takeaways from Super Tuesday, most of it talking about how Trump is some like dictator in the wings or whatever. Right. But they had a section talking about how Democrats bruised Biden again, and mentioned how, yes, he did win all 15 states, but like Chris said, there was large percentages that voted for uncommitted, or in the case of American Samoa, some guy from Baltimore. But they attribute this, especially in the vote, the nearly 20% of Democrats in Minnesota voting for uncommitted, they attributed that to the ongoing stuff with Israel and Gaza and the kind of the growing discontent among a wing of Democrats that sees Biden's kind of handling of the whole situation as being less than stellar. And I think we saw another example of that. I wish I sent the video. I didn't realize I was going to bring this up. But recently, a couple of protesters were accosting AOC, our second favorite socialist, outside of a movie theater and chasing her around, you know, trying to get her to call what's going on a genocide. And she had to run away and have her boyfriend yell at them. But it just shows that, like, you know, if there is some growing friction factions going on in the GOP, there certainly is some going in the Democrat Party as well. But Jim, final thoughts on this and we can get on to our main topic.
Yeah, I mean, one of the takeaways was that, you know, there's a danger in the election results for Trump, you know, based on the support that Nikki Haley was able to get in socialist Vermont and Washington, D.C. Oh, my gosh, that's really reflective of the electorate. In fact, I think I saw a poll where they showed that, you know, you don't have to. There isn't a blood test, for instance, to prove that you're a Republican to vote in a Republican primary or in any primary for that matter. I saw a poll that showed that I think 87% of people who voted for Nikki Haley in one of the primaries in one of the states, something like 87% approved of Biden's handling of the economy and thought he was doing a great job as president and would vote for him again. So the idea that, you know, Trump's in trouble or the Republican faction, you know, the Republican base is fractured and all this stuff. I don't think that dog hunts very much. But what was also interesting about the New York Times coverage was that they actually covered what he said after his big Super Tuesday. You know, I mean, let's put this in perspective. Donald Trump is sweeping these primary and especially Super Tuesday as if he is a sitting incumbent and has no one running against him. This really is kind of historic that I think this has to be. I didn't look it up, but it's either the most delegates that a non-incumbent in a so-called open primary for the Republican nomination has ever gathered, ever. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that Ronald Reagan did in 1984, and Donald Trump is doing it pretty much on his own. So, you know, but of course, the media doesn't want to cover that stuff. But at least the New York Times says Trump speech previews dark themes for the fall. So at least they actually played or covered his speech and let their readers know what he said, unlike MSNBC, which famously refuses to air anything Trump says live because they don't believe in letting lies be broadcast without correction. And he just spews so many lies that we can't correct them in fast enough that we just decided that viewers of MSNBC, like our own Chris Talgo, are just not allowed to see Trump speak live ever. But the so-called dark speech, he says, frankly, our country is dying. Anyone want to disagree with that? Nope, I didn't think so. Another crazy dark thing he said was that, you know, he said he doesn't get enough credit for the way he handled COVID. Now, if he wants to irritate Republicans, especially conservatives, and especially this one, keep talking about how great you did on COVID, Donald Trump. That'll really get me excited. But putting all that aside, you know, this is the weirdest political season ever. I mean, nobody's paying attention to these races. Everybody already knows. And now it's, I guess, officially locked in, Trump versus Biden. And now Biden, who is his cognitive decline. Gosh, when we used to play clips of him, guys, like a year ago, I thought those were bad. It is so bad now. The only reason to watch the State of the Union tonight, in my mind, is to see if he's able to actually form real sentences as he reads it off a teleprompter in 50-point type. So we'll see if he can pull that off.
Yeah, no, it's, I don't know. When is even the Illinois primary? Like
March 19th, I think.
March 19th, great. Like it's going to be like wrapped up before that, I think. I think he's like 400 votes away for delegates away from like the threshold where he becomes like it or whatever. That'll probably be wrapped up before the end of the month for sure, but All right, we got plenty to talk about. I do have a Davos Watch segment planned for the end of the episode, so make sure that you stay tuned for that one. But I wanted to talk about electric vehicles for a while now. I know that our climate realism show on Fridays at noon on the Heartland Institute channel is they talk about this topic a lot. But it's one that we historically have talked about a lot as well. And I've seen a few articles recently that we were actually planning on doing a little behind the curtains. We were planning on doing an electric vehicles episode a couple of weeks ago before something else happened that, like, you know, took precedent over what we were going to talk about. So I kept pushing it off. But now I've seen a handful of articles that were pointing to this idea that perhaps electric vehicles are worse for the environment than internal combustion engines. And I thought, all right, now's the time. We're going to talk about this topic. So I've got a handful of things that fall under this umbrella of electric vehicles. So let's get into it, shall we? So most recently, I think we talked about the lack of EV commercials during the Super Bowl and how this is correlated to the lackluster sales of electric vehicles countrywide. This week, though, the Wall Street Journal published an article titled "Electric Cars Emit More Particulate Pollution." Now, how could this possibly be? I thought that electric vehicles were super clean. They don't spew exhaust, so how could they possibly pollute more than internal combustion vehicles? Perhaps they're pointing out, if you read through this article, maybe they're going to be pointing out that, you know, in most places, electric vehicles are charged with electricity produced by burning coal, right? Like the whole concept of coal-powered cars. Maybe that's what the article is talking about. No, that's not what it's talking about. Maybe it's going to be talking about the batteries of electric vehicles and how they're massive and require crazy amounts of rare earth materials, which require massive mining operations in third world countries and all that. Nope, that's not what this article is talking about. The article is actually about a study by Emissions Analytics from a few years ago that analyzing the actual particulate matter resulting specifically from the car driving itself. So again, how could this possibly be? It doesn't even have an exhaust pipe. According to this report, modern internal combustion engines have become so clean that the majority of their particulate emissions don't even come from the tailpipe. In fact, most of a car's particulate emissions comes from the wear of its tires. So reading from this article, it says, cars are heavy, and as their tires rub against the road, they degrade and release tiny, often toxic particles. According to measurements by a Mission Analytics firm, in gasoline cars equipped with particulate filters, airborne tire wear emissions are more than 400 times as great as direct exhaust particulate emissions. Electric cars weigh far more than gasoline-powered ones, so their tires degrade faster, as the electric car buyers are learning. The same analytics firm cited earlier compared two cars, a plug-in electric and a hybrid. The electric car weighed about one-third more than the hybrid and emitted roughly one-quarter more particulate matter because of tire wear. Total direct emissions went up, not down, when the electric car was driven. So how ridiculous is this? I mean, California is trying to ban the sale of new gasoline-powered cars by 2035, claiming that the ban would prevent public harm by reducing particulate matter. In reality, according to this study, it actually would increase public harm by increasing particulate matter. So, Jim, I mean, we've talked about bans on gasoline-powered cars, how it would be terrible for a whole bunch of different reasons, strain on the grid, increased use of rare earth materials, mandating more expensive cars in the population. But this was all supposed to have at least one benefit, less pollution from the actual cars driving down the streets. Turns out that little consolation prize that we were promised isn't even the case either. So just add this all on to the negative effects of these government mandates. What are your thoughts on this study?
Wow, negative unintended consequences from a leftist harebrained scheme? That's never happened before. I can't believe it. This is really, really shocking. Look, even I was surprised by this. And Chris Shattuck, who's in our chat, to him, this is old news. He apparently knew about this already. But you know, we follow this, and I follow this story, this topic of electric vehicles very closely. And this was the first time I've heard of that. And it's actually, I think the takeaway from that Wall Street Journal story is that, again, obviously the particulate matter that's in the air, it's not necessarily dangerous. There's if you follow Steve Malloy on X from junkscience.com, he has a whole book on the EPA standards for particulate matter, which are, you know, frankly, ridiculous. That, in other words, the air is already clean enough. But if we're going to hold to the standards that the environmental left, especially in California, wants us all to adhere to, then they have to be held to the same standards that they put everybody else to. And I just think it's hilarious that they want to ban the internal combustion engine in California by 2035. But then you learn that actually electric vehicles will make the air pollution worse than if they just left those gas-powered cars on the road. And one of the takeaways from this is that at some point, it's clean enough. I mean, I don't mean to sound cold or that I think pollution is great or anything like that, but the problem with ever, you keep ratcheting up federal regulations, and it starts to become the cost benefit is so out of whack that it costs billions of dollars to get this much more benefit of cleaning the air. And we're frankly at the point where regulations on tailpipe emissions should be done, over with. Just in this story, it shows that cars emit so little amount of particulate matter in the state of California. And you have to realize everybody's got a car in California. The highways are just always packed. It's clean enough. And you don't need to ban the internal combustion engine, a regular gas vehicle in California, unless you are a maniac, like apparently they are in California, because not only are electric vehicles much, much heavier, and thus they wear through tires very quickly. I know a few guys who have Teslas, and they're like, yeah, it's kind of fun, but boy, I go through tires pretty fast. And I thought that was weird, but now I understand why. They have these vehicles, and they're so heavy. What we're also finding is, they damage the road, of course, because they're so heavy. There was a story I saw the other week. We may have even mentioned it on the podcast, guys, that guardrails along highways are not strong enough for electric vehicles if they slam into them at speed, because the electric vehicles are too heavy and they'll just smash right through those guardrails. So once again, the rule of unintended consequences always comes back to bite, and it always comes back to bite seemingly another harebrained leftist scheme.
Yeah, you know, I feel like so many people with electric vehicles, they don't realize like the battery size of it. Like even I didn't until like we started talking about this. You know, just imagine like, oh yeah, maybe the engine just has like a larger battery. You've got the ones in our normal cars have a battery that's about this big. Maybe the other ones, I don't know, a couple times as big. But no, it's like the whole body of the car is like a battery. And then once you realize that, it makes sense that the cars are so much heavier. I think in this article, they suggested that it was like, you know, anywhere average from like 15% to 30%. I thought it was even more than that. But I started hearing that this idea that the electric vehicles were so much heavier in relation to a story that was concerned about the structural integrity of parking garages. Because if we had the same amount of cars that were parked there, but instead just replace them with electric vehicles, it'd be, you know, somewhere, according to this article, 15 to 30% heavier than just the sheer amount of weight. So then, you know, this story with the wear on the tires, like I never even occurred to me that this would be a problem until somebody mentions it. Go ahead, Chris.
I've got a very different take on this story.
Okay.
Okay, so as far as I know, one of the reasons why cars are made to be lighter nowadays is because of the CAFE standards. And car manufacturers used to use steel, especially in bumpers and such. And those are much safer, because if you're in a, especially in a lightweight compact car, and you're in a high speed collision, that thing is, you know, it's like folding. So I actually think that substantial heavy cars with, you know, steel frames are the way that we should build cars. And I think that all this stuff about particulate matter and all that is just a bunch of BS. This is, you know, people who are talking about 1 trillionth of 1 billionth of 1 zillionth, whatever, does not matter. You know, highway safety is very important. I would much rather have people survive car accidents by being in a safe car than by trying to make cars as light as possible so that when they do get into accidents, the odds of someone getting hurt is much higher. So I just have a completely different take on this. And I'm sorry, but, you know, like part of the reason why our roads don't hold up is also because we don't build them deep enough. You know, the Autobahn was built before World War II. And guess what? They built it much deeper than American roads are. And it's held up to this day. So I think a lot of this stuff is, you know, just trying to save pennies here and there. And, you know, constantly the, you know, transportation department having to resurface roads. It's a boondoggle. It's just a way for them to increase their budgets. So I just am completely opposite on this one.
Well, what do you mean opposite, though? Like, is the takeaway
because I don't think that we should be bad mouthing electric vehicles simply because of the weight of them. I don't think that that's the argument to be made here. I think they're dangerous for a bunch of other reasons. But I actually think one of the reasons why we, you know, want to have cars that are heavier is because they are safer. I mean, that's just common sense.
Okay. Well, first off, Andy, go ahead and start playing some of that footage showing how safe these cars are.
You're missing my point, dude. You're completely missing my point. My point is that electric vehicles are safer. That is not my point whatsoever. They are much less safe.
Okay. Wait. I think you're missing my point.
I'm telling you.
Tell me my point. Go ahead.
Well, I'm not telling you your point, but what I'm saying is that the point of that article, I disagree with that article. That article is saying that the sheer weight of electric vehicles is a major problem because then the tires wear faster and particulate matter for emanating from tires is a dangerous pollution problem. I've done some research and that's just not true. So heavy cars are actually safer. You know, BMW 750 ILs are built with a steel frame. That means that you can take a dump truck and, you know, sideswipe it, and that's not going to do anything. Yeah, but that car is really heavy. That's why SUVs are so heavy, because they're big cars and they have, you know, steel frames. That's what you want to have, because when you have two cars colliding, you don't want them to be made of, you know, plasticky materials where they hit each other and they slam and the cars, you know, fold together like an accordion. I'm serious. You guys are laughing, but it's like,
I think you're completely missing the point of the article. I don't think the point of the article is to criticize these cars simply for being heavy. I think that is something that people don't realize and should take into account.
But that was the point of the article in terms of the particulate matter that.
No, it's just pointing out that's the reason why, and that people wouldn't realize it. And this whole bill of sales that were being sold, that these cars are actually cleaner because of the, you know, all of these different reasons. It's not the case. That's all the article is saying, that these cars aren't cleaner than the other ones.
No, but this article, I read the entire article. I understand exactly what they're saying. What they're saying is that EVs are heavier than gasoline powered cars in general. Yes, that is true. They are 15 to 20% heavier. Okay. Right. And then they're saying because of that added weight, the tires go faster, and the tires by going faster, not literally spinning faster, but by wearing faster, produce more particulate matter into the atmosphere, and that's dangerous. We should really try to reduce particulate matter. My thing is like, whoa, you're completely off on this.
No, that's not the last takeaway of the article. The article is just saying that this idea that these cars are cleaner on the road isn't necessarily the case because of this factor that people don't factor in, because they don't realize that.
I understand that we all agree that the real reason why they're unsafe is for, you know, problems much more related to the battery, which catch fire and all that kind of stuff. But what I'm saying is that if you were to take this to its logical conclusion, then you were saying if you were to say I'm worried about particulate matter and tires wearing fast, well, then I want to make, and this has been the talking point for the past 30 years. It's coming from CAFE, coming from the California emission standards, where they're 20, 30, 40 years ago, they said, whoa, we want to make cars much lighter. And the reason was, well, they'll have better gas mileage, you know, and they will not produce as much emissions. But the what's happened over the past 30 years is that highway fatalities have gone up because when a light vehicle and another light vehicle that don't have, you know, like a steel, you know, chassis or that they don't have, you know, steel, you know, plates, when they collide at high speeds, they both, you know, just completely fold into each other. And that results in much more highway deaths. So therefore, in a perfect world in which we say particulate matter from tires wearing faster doesn't matter at all, and we're not, you know, obsessed with getting, you know, our emissions, you know, as low as possible, we would. I don't understand why you're like laughing.
All right, Let's bring some sense to this, Jim. You can defuse the situation.
Yeah. You know, I wonder if we keep arguing with each other if we're going to get more viewers or repel the viewers at this point. But look, Chris, all that is taken as a given. That's fine. I mean, but right. I think an engineer in our chat mentioned that these cars, these heavy Teslas and other battery powered cars, are heavy for a different reason than a 1978 Chevy Impala is heavy. You know, they're still made of lighter materials. They try to make them as light as they can, obviously,
Jim, but
they can't make them any lighter because the batteries weigh so darn much.
And yeah,
so
I understand all that.
And the article does not say anything about any of the stuff you said. The Heartland Studios covered CAFE standards and how they are dumb and make cars less safe for 30 something years.
But that's embedded in the argument. That's embedded in the argument.
The entire point of this story, Chris, was just that Teslas are sold, that they are clean riding, they are clean manufactured, they are clean for the air, they're better and superior to the
environment. But we know that that's not true. No.
The only point was that they are not.
We know. I'm agreeing with you that that is not true. However, embedded in the article, in the logic of the article, is that hence gasoline powered cars are even better because they do not wear tires out as frequently, therefore you have less particulate. And I'm saying that is completely wrong too, because then, but if you take that to its logical conclusion, then let's just keep making cars lighter and lighter and lighter and lighter because now we're scared about particulate matter from tires. I'm saying no, don't fall into that trap. We actually would be better off if we made cars heavier and more substantial, because then they would be safer, and then you would have less deaths as a result of car crashes. It's like, I don't understand so difficult to understand.
No, we could have it. If you want to have another episode about CAFE standards, we could do that. And I think that we would all be in agreement. But when you come on and you're saying that you have a completely different takeaway than this article or us talking about it.
Because I'm not using this as a way to, like, you know, say, oh, look, the electric vehicles are terrible because of particulate matter. I'm saying particulate matter doesn't matter anyways.
Chris, neither of us said or believe that the reason the EVs are not saying that is because of particulate matter. We are noting that this is a little factoid that is not very well reported, and we thought we'd bring it to the attention of people. And now we are moving on to the next story, please. I don't want to keep going around. This is boring me, let alone our listeners right now.
Yeah, it turns out that when you show the study, based on all the factors, take into account all of this. What's funny is California, when challenged with these findings that the particulate matter is actually worse in these heavier vehicles, EV vehicles, that they said, well, you know, give it time, and these cars are going to get lighter as they go. You know, we're gonna find out better ways of manufacturing these things, and they're going to be lighter. As if those ways of figuring out how to make EV cars lighter aren't going to also go on to internal combustion engines. So all of that is just even across the field, in my opinion. But again, you know, all of this stuff, we're going to have to deal with the strain on the grid and potential more rolling blackouts when it comes to, you know, the base load energy and all of that, and everyone charging these at peak hours and all of that, and increased rare earth materials, and how we need to, you know, buy more rare earth materials from China, and all these negative consequences. The cars themselves are more expensive, less reliable, smaller range, longer charge times, so the potential for car fires, how impossible it is to put these cars out if they do catch on fire. The idea that they lose all their efficiency if they're in cold temperatures. You have stories about buses filled with kids being stranded in Minnesota because it's too cold for the buses to run, or people unable to charge their cars during cold snaps, even here in Chicago. But we're going to deal with all of that because it means that the pollution from the cars themselves is actually going to be lesser than internal combustion engines. Turns out that's not the case. That's the only point that I'm trying to make with all of this. I don't care about the CAFE standards. That's a totally different discussion. But yes, let's move on, please. So there's apparently something that's going on that's brewing in regards to a potential loophole in the trade agreements between the United States and Mexico that the Chinese now are looking to exploit. So there's trade agreements that have encouraged trade between North American countries, putting countries like China at a disadvantage when it comes to selling electric vehicles in America. Well, Chinese firms are getting crafty, apparently, and there is now a plan for Chinese car companies to open up manufacturing plants in Mexico. So they plan on doing the majority of the construction of their EVs in Mexico. If they open up a plant there, they'll make all the components in China, then have them shipped over to Mexico where they construct the vehicles and then just ship them across the border, avoiding much of the majority of the different tariffs that are leveled. So China makes cheap versions of everything, including EVs now. So even the small tariffs that and the somewhat kind of backwards way of producing the products, they might end up cheaper than some of the electric vehicle competition in America. So Senator Josh Hawley wrote a piece in Fox News laying all of this out and showing how Biden's agenda and plans are playing right into this scheme by overburdening automakers with regulations while simultaneously encouraging EV purchases throughout the country. I haven't heard about this loophole concept. The idea of China setting up an EV plant just outside of the United States and Mexico just so they could cheaply bring them across the border. Something I hadn't heard of. Jim, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, we shouldn't be building any EV plants anywhere because there isn't a real market for EVs in the United States. And besides, did I mention that they're really heavy and they wear out their tires? No, you know what? I'm just going to move on from that one. But yeah, I mean, I think the headline of the story actually made me laugh. Says stop Chinese EVs before they destroy our auto industry. That headline is perfect when you take, even if you take out the word Chinese, EVs are destroying our auto industry. The big three car makers, are there even three anymore? But the big car makers today in the United States have bought into the idea that a vibrant electric vehicle market will just spring out of the earth like a mushroom or something. But what they were counting on was that government mandates would make it that is the only vehicles that will ever be allowed to be produced will be electric. I mean, that has to be why Ford is basically laying off thousands of workers, converting all their factories to make EVs, and then watching them sit unused in lots everywhere. And in fact, I know that on the Climate Realism show tomorrow that the guys in Linnea are going to be talking about this topic as well. And one of the stories they pulled up was how the Ford CEO got a reality check when he took an electric F-150 Lightning on a road trip. He says, shifting from fueling stations to charging stations requires new behaviors. He found it difficult to go on a long distance trip in his brand new state-of-the-art F-150 Lightning pickup truck. So when even the Ford CEO knows that he's sitting in a lemon, there should be no EV factories built anywhere.
China, on that point,
China could build them all they want and put their own people in it, but there's really no reason for an electric vehicle to be anything other than a third or fourth fun local vehicle for the super wealthy. Everybody else should just be able to buy whatever they can afford and whatever the heck they want.
So on that point of the limited range and that reality check thing, I just saw a commercial for an app that you can get if you're going to take like a road trip somewhere, and you could plot your destination and your point of origin, and it'll like show you all the charging stations and how long and things you can do in the area or all sorts of stuff. Like you need plans, man, to go out on a road trip if you're taking one of these vehicles. But yeah, Chris, loopholes and the, in the trade agreements and all of that, exploited by China, them trying to sell us cheap garbage knockoffs. Probably not surprising, but what are your thoughts on this one?
Okay, so on this one, I've also got a little bit of a different take.
Where's that mute button?
Are you ready?
I can mute them. Yeah, I'll do it. Right. Go ahead.
Stop it, guys. Come on.
No, go ahead.
Like censorship? Like, give me a break. Come on.
All right.
Free speech, guys. Come on. No. Free market, free speech. So just like the Chinese have been shown to be dumping steel, washing machines, all sorts of appliances and other things in the United States. When Donald Trump was in the presidency, what he did was he put tariffs on there. So he, said, hey, we don't want you dumping your, cheaper stuff because it's subsidized by the Communist Party into our market. Well, what's going on here is you've got the Chinese saying we want to enter the American EV market. So we want to set up factories in Mexico and then we want to sell EVs that are going to be much lower than the American versions, like Ford and Chevrolet and, such. And really, I think what Holly, because I read, Holly's argument, and I think what Holly was really saying was, hey, no, we don't want another competitor to enter into the American EV market. And I think what he was really saying was the EV market in America is already struggling enough. We do not need another entrant into it. So I don't think that he was making the case that, hey, EVs are terrible. And I agree with you and Jim, obviously. They're unreliable. They cost too much money. The range is terrible. Once the batteries go, you basically have to get rid of the car. There are all sorts of problems with EVs. I am by no means at all trying to say that I am, in support of EVs. However, if you really want to take a, libertarian free market approach to this, you would say no, that, free trade. However, I don't take that approach on this one because I think that the Chinese do not play by fair rules and there is no such thing as fair trade with the Chinese. They steal intellectual property. They, they dump government subsidized products to try to get a foothold in these industries. And I think that the Chinese think that this is going to be the future of, auto manufacturing. So they are trying to get a foothold here in the American market. I think that Holly is taking more of a protectionist approach to this. I agree with that, generally speaking, because I agree with Trump's trade war with China. But I do not think that we should try to ban cheap Chinese EVs from impacting the American market because we want the American market for EVs to thrive. Because guess what? The American market for EVs is not thriving, even with a whole bunch of government subsidies, like the $8,500 taxpayer credit and all the, corruption and shenanigans that's going on there. So really, I think my stance on this is very simple. If EVs can compete with gasoline-powered cars in a free and open market, then let it be. But it's been shown that they can't over the past 5 to 10 years, despite the Inflation Reduction Act, despite all these subsidies. And for Holly to say, oh, no, we don't want to have the Chinese dumping their even cheaper EVs into our market because that will further harm the American EV market. I don't buy into that.
I'd have to look at that Fox News article again, but I think the point that he was trying to make in the first half of that article was that these mandates from the government that were enforcing certain percentages of sales from American car companies to be electric vehicles was part of the burden that was undermining the auto market in the first place. So not necessarily that he wants our EVs to compete better against their EVs. He wants all of those mandates to be erased so that they can go back to making good internal combustion engine cars and not have to worry about this. Because when they do have to worry about this and they're saddled with all of this trying to hawk products that the American people don't want, it's giving a little bit of an advantage to China that are doing it this way with their cheap knockoff versions of the technology that they're stealing from us.
And you can apply that also with like appliances. If China's going to try to make cheap ovens and cheap gas stoves and then flood the market so that GE and Whirlpool can compete, well, I would rather have trade restrictions in place and I would rather have tariffs in place on those, cheap Chinese products because they're basically replicas of the American technology in the first place.
Yeah, yeah, like Temu and AliExpress and all of that. People, please be aware of this. I mean, it's just their way of selling cheap knockoff gadget Chinese spyware to Americans, right, and we're buying it up because it's $10 cheaper or something like that. And now we're going to get cheap knockoff spyware electric vehicles shipped across us from Mexico from Chinese plants. So let's be aware of it. Let's not buy those things, but. Jim, one other thing about this point that I found interesting when I was reading up about this was that a lot of this also has to do with kind of the geopolitics between the United States and Mexico, and how the current president of Mexico is a little bit more cavalier, apparently, with his trade deals or the way that he interacts with the United States, which is basically putting in a situation where he's courting China and, you know, we won't report these certain things because, you know, that would put, you know, even more stringent tariffs on you or whatever. So it's like we can't even rely on Mexico to kind of police that whole tariff system that we've got set up with the USMCA or whatever that agreement was. So, yeah, that's also kind of working in China's favor to pull off a scheme like this. But any other words on this before we move on to our last bit of our main section?
Let's go to the last bit.
Donnie, just real quick. First, it was called the YMCA, not the USMCA. Just kidding. And second of all, I think another part of this is that China's Belt and Road Initiative is actually starting to enter South America and Latin America. And we should be pushing back against that. We do not want our arch enemy to have satellite, you know, factories in Mexico. Look what they're doing already with the fentanyl production in Mexico.
Sure.
They're also sending Chinese military age men to Mexico and then crossing the border.
Yeah. And let's check the trunks of all these cars that they're going to be shipping across the border.
No, but in all seriousness, you know, we want to resurrect the Monroe Doctrine and say, hey, China, you stay in your part of the world. You know, we don't want you in our literal backyard. You know, producing cars and smuggling, you know, fentanyl and who knows what else is going on there. So I think that that's just another aspect of this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't think that they have any factories being built yet. This is all just kind of in like the planning phases, but it's something that we should be keeping an eye on for sure. Okay. All right. Last topic when it comes to this before Davos Watch. Elon Musk, German Tesla plant suffers close to $1 billion in damages after attack by, quote, dumbest eco-terrorists on Earth. And I think that was a quote from Elon Musk. But so this story centers around the Gigafactory in Europe, or in Germany, Brandenburg, Germany. Apparently, it was the first Tesla Gigafactory ever made in Europe. And it was such a big deal. This is a couple of years ago that it was built. That multiple cities and countries were campaigning for the factory because they knew that it would bring along with it all this economic advantage, thousands of jobs, making whatever location it landed the green epicenter, you know, basically overnight. So this was built, it started production, I think just like a couple of years ago, actually like producing cars, I mean. And then a fire was set to the energy transformers for the factory that completely cut power to the factory. I think it is still out to this day. Several days of complete outages, losses to the factory to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, the headline suggested it was close to $1 billion. Cars literally half complete sitting on conveyor belts and all the workers just kind of twiddling their thumbs until they're able to turn the electricity back on. And apparently a group, this was suspected arson right off the bat, but a far left eco group took credit for it, called the Vulcan Group or the Volcano Group, depending on your translation of the group's name.
Vulcan Group.
Vulcan Group. They're all Vulcan about Group Star Trek. And
I'm German, so that's what I'm just telling you.
That's it. I didn't know he was German. Get him off the podcast, Andy. All right. So they released a letter taking credit for the attack, saying, well, first off, I won't be able to read the entire letter. It's like 45 pages long. All of these leftist people are just so long-winded when it comes to them explaining their worldview. Anyways, in short, it said, we sabotage Tesla. Tesla concerns Earth, resources, people, workers, and in return spits out 6,000 SUVs, killer cars, and monster trucks each week. because the complete destruction of the Gigafactory, and with it the sawing off of techno-fascists like Elon Musk, are a step on the path to liberation from the patriarchy. And when I saw this, I just like, I went from just like, you know, seeing how terrible the whole industry for electric vehicles are going, and it got me to a point where I'm like, I almost feel bad for them. It almost just feels so hopeless for the EV industry when the biggest EV manufacturer out there, Tesla, is being targeted by the far, far, far left for not being like eco-conscious enough. And it's not even for like the right reasons, you know, like the reasons that we point out that they're actually environmentally destructive and all of that. It's for like their far leftist reasons. So even when Elon Musk and Tesla are being targeted, Chris, does this industry have any hope to like to completely replace internal combustion engine vehicles? Seems unlikely. What are your thoughts?
I don't think so, because there's not consumer demand there for it. And right. I'm talking about not in Germany, but especially in the United States of America. The United States of America is a giant landmass. People need to drive vast distances sometimes. Europe, maybe these EVs would work better, because the European countries tend to be much smaller. People don't tend to travel as much in as far in Europe. To be honest, I was kind of a little bit shocked by the fact that the Tesla factory was, you know, targeted. But then also, let's remember that this is a good old former East Germany. And even though it's been 30 years since East and West Germany were reunited, East Germany still has a fairly strong socialist, communist, collectivist, you know, mantra to it. And I also perused the letter, and it was just a bunch of, it almost seemed like it was from the, you know, Stasi circa like 1986 or so, you know. So I expect this might actually start to happen more in, you know, crazy countries like, you know, Germany, which is sad to say because my family comes from there. But Germany is just...
Oh, my God. I'm surrounded by Germans, everyone.
Germany's in shambles right now. I told you. My mom was born there. I've been there a few times. We've got family there. Our family there told us that electricity is now so allocated that they don't even have streetlights on at night. That just goes to show you like how scarce it is. So, you know, I think Germany's a basket case. Europe's, you know, on the precipice of becoming a basket case. And I just hope that that does not happen the way that it has in the United States of America, because, you know, Germany was on the cutting edge of this, you know, transformation into green power in the early 1990s. And here they are 30 years later, and it's just completely blown up in their face. And, you know, we should learn from their mistake.
Blow up in their face. Cue the video, Andy. Show more of that. EV is going kaboom. Yeah. Jim, thoughts on this story? Or I could tee you up for that CNN one if you wanted to talk about that.
Sure.
Yeah, well, the CNN... So I was just like, you know, finding some other articles that related to the, you know, how terrible EVs are doing just basically in any metric nowadays. And I found this article, and I put it in the show notes just simply because of the title of it. But it was a CNN article titled "How EVs Became Such a Massive Disappointment."
Yeah.
And it's like, I tried to fit in as many reasons why is a disappointment in here. Like, do we need CNN to explain us why it is? Because I feel like we cover that pretty extensively. Jim, what are your thoughts on the CNN article?
Yeah, I mean, it gives the reasons of high prices that they're, you know, between $50,000 and $60,000. Now we get a Kia and we get a Cadillac. I don't know what exactly that's supposed to mean. But yeah, the idea that you pay the cheapest of your electric vehicles are what you would pay for a high-end luxury vehicle that runs on gasoline or even a hybrid. The reason electric vehicles have been so how they became, I just like you, I love the headline, how EVs became such a massive disappointment, because there isn't a market for it. Let's state this as often as possible. This is a completely artificially created market. The mass electric vehicle market does not and will not exist. Not unless driving an electric vehicle is as easy and convenient and as safe, frankly, as driving a regular vehicle. If you could pull into a battery station and change the battery of your car every 200 miles, that would approach the kind of convenience that would be that a gasoline powered car has. Until something like that happens, they will never be anything but a niche product for the super wealthy to go around locally. And the only reason there is a market at all for electric vehicles is because of government regulations. I don't want to go back into the CAFE standards argument again, but that's really what this comes down to, is that these car manufacturers have to have a average car, efficiency, I should say, mileage number, and they keep ratcheting it up. And the only way you're going to get there is if you do electric cars, which don't have any emissions at all, quote unquote. And so this entire thing is government mandated. There's right. not a market for any of this because they might catch on fire. They're super heavy. You have to charge them at home. Your electric bill goes up, all sorts of reasons. These are impractical for just about any normal American family.
Yeah, and we've talked about
people just don't want them. And Donnie, just real quick, we haven't even talked about the charging station problem. I live close to a Woodman's. Woodman's has, I think, probably 20 chargers. Every single time I go there, there are probably 40 Teslas and other electric vehicle cars just waiting to be charged. So, I mean, if we don't have the infrastructure in place to charge these, you know, in a way that is, you know, efficient, then I don't understand how you could ever like own one and get around in like a timely manner. And I remember when the IRA was passed, which is the most ill-named law I've ever heard in my life, they said that they were going to spend, you know, like hundreds of billions and have all these charging stations. Guess what? That was 2 years ago. Not a single one charging station has been built from the IRA funds. Just like with Obama's, you know, 2008 giant infrastructure plan, where it was like years later and he joked, oh, the shovel projects weren't really shovel ready. Same damn thing. You know, same damn thing. This really, what this is to me is, this is all about cronyism and corruption and people in high government positions doing favors to donors and their friends in high places who just happen to be in the EV business. Like if you go and look into like John Kerry and like his family's connections to EVs and such, like, wow, it's just so strange that they're making all this money off this stuff.
Yeah. You know, and one other thing that we've talked about on this podcast a million times is the idea of like the subsidies, just the straight up subsidies, whether it's federal or state subsidies for electric vehicles. We always talked about how that's like a subsidy for the rich, that, you know, you're getting $10,000 off a $70,000 car or something along those lines. But in this world that we're going towards with California and, you know, perhaps seeing it spread across into other states and around the country, across the country, is that if we are forcing everybody to go into electric vehicles, whether we're subsidizing or just mandating it, what are people going to choose? They're going to choose the most inexpensive version on there. If we're being forced to do an electric vehicle, we're going to get the cheapest one. And if that China goes along with their plan, it's probably going to be those Chinese knockoff ones. So that's another thing that we should be keeping an eye out.
But the real big picture, like the 30,000 foot big picture, I think is that when I talk about they, I talk about, you know, our ruling class, you know, the elites, they actually don't want us to have the ability to travel freely and frequently. So that's why I think they wanted to say no more gasoline powered cars. You don't need to drive all those places. You don't need to have all that freedom to travel as you want. Therefore, sure, get an EV. And, you know, once they ban gasoline powered cars and make EVs, you know, the new norm. Remember, they can also track. They can also, like, you know, quote unquote, like control the EV. It's, oh, you've gone too many miles so far. So really, I think that's what this is about. It's about a long term plan in place, maybe 20, 30 years down the road, where, you know, we look back and say, man, remember those good old days when you could just get in your car and go and, you know, gas it up and go on a cross country trip, and how cool right. that was. I think that's just not going to be in the cards anymore.
And yeah, we'll say, remember the good old days, you know, when our cars wouldn't just spontaneously combust, like we're seeing happen here in these videos that we're playing.
Remember the good old days in Germany when we had street lights that could light up the streets instead of just periodic flaming EV cars every once in a while on the road.
I just want to say this is my favorite clip. I mean, this is horrifying. This is like something out of like zombie apocalypse movie where the entire bus is on fire and it is just out of control, yeah, rolling down the street. That is horrifying. How was
for
this-
the audio only listeners?
I'm waiting to see like a Terminator like emerge from that.
Oh, you know? nice reference. For those audio only listeners, in the video version of the podcast, we've been showing a montage of just electric vehicle fires that are going on. And like I mentioned very briefly, I don't exactly know how more likely cars, electric vehicles are to catch on fire as opposed to their internal combustion vehicle counterparts. But I do know that when they do catch fire, they're like literally impossible to put out. There was one video that I think you guys showed on the Climate Realism show a couple of, I don't know, weeks ago, where it was an electric vehicle that was on fire literally underwater. Literally underwater. Like, you could submerge the entire thing literally underwater and it would still be on fire. That's how crazy these lithium batteries
and municipalities are having to buy special equipment. I wrote an article about this a couple months ago because one of our northern suburbs close to where we're located had to spend tens and tens and tens of thousands of dollars on special equipment that is made to specifically put out EV fires. So yeah, that's just another, like, you know, added cost to all this.
Thank you, producer Andy, for pulling that video up on the fly. But yeah, there it is. There's an electric underwater while on fire. But all right. That's enough electric vehicle hate. I think they're actually going to be talking about this topic and more that relate to it on the Climate Realism show, which is live on noon on Fridays on Heartland's main YouTube channel. So make sure to check that in if you want further stuff talking about this. But I do have a very short Davos Watch segment for us all. So let's go ahead and play that bumper music if we have it ready. All right. Welcome to Davos Watch, where we keep an eye on the global elites from Davos to the UN and all the other advocates of global fascism and totalitarian technocracy. This week, I wanted to cover some good news. How often is that the case on Davos Watch? Well, for constant viewers of our main show, the In the Tank podcast on Stopping Socialism TV, you'll know that we have extensively covered the topic of ESG for years. This is environmental, social, and governance metrics. I'll remind everyone that Justin Haskins and I worked with Glenn Beck on the book, The Great Reset, which exposed The Great Reset, explained the agenda of the World Economic Forum and their so-called stakeholder capitalist economic system that would be used to control society. The backbone of this Great Reset system is ESG. ESG is the corporate social credit score used by rulers so that they can punish some industries and companies while rewarding those that are politically favored. We have been pushing back against this hijacking of the economic decision-making for a long time now, exposing the concept to millions of people, and even working to provoke some legislative action across the country. One of the lesser acknowledged aspects of the ESG scheme was the plan in the European Union to codify ESG into law. The plan would require businesses in the European Union to adhere to the whims of central planners. Worse than that, it would require that any firm anywhere in the world that does business in the European Union to conform to ESG dictates. If passed, the ESG scheme would quickly spread across the world, impacting businesses throughout the United States. So we've been talking about this point. We've been writing about this whenever possible, because it's just as impactful as any ESG actions happening in the United States. If this were to take hold in the European Union, like I said, it would spread very quickly across the world. Well, just this past week, the European ESG plan came up for a vote in the European Council. In the EU, it's called the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive. So we've been following this pretty closely. In the weeks leading up to the vote, we were hearing that there was a minority party in Germany that was pulling their support for the directive, leaving the entire plan in jeopardy. However, in the days leading up to the vote, it appeared as though that they might actually be in support after all, after they were offered certain concessions on other outstanding legislation that was going to be taken up for a vote during the same session. Well, the vote went down last week, and the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive went down in flames. Not only did the German group hold out their support, but so did Italy and France, and I think there was one other country that also voted it down. So this is potentially huge. Not only was it voted down, but we are quickly approaching a European Union legislative deadline before their elections. Add on top of this that most people are expecting a general conservative shift in the upcoming European Union elections. So it is very possible that not only is this ESG plan dead in the European Union, but it might stay dead for the foreseeable future. So you are welcome, America. The Heartland Institute, the Socialism Research Center, Glenn Beck, and other allies in this cause have fought tirelessly to expose the problem of ESG as far and wide as possible. And I believe some of those warnings were even heeded across the ocean in Europe. Now, before we celebrate too much, there is a potential post-credits jump scare, hand coming out of the grave scene that could possibly happen in the next week here. There is talk of a last-minute rushed, watered-down version of this plan that could be jammed into the session before this March 15th deadline. I'm not sure how likely this is to pass in this form and fashion. It seems like a desperation move, but who knows? So we're going to be keeping an eye on this in the European Union and other ESG movements across the United States. More importantly, we'll be fighting against it as much as we possibly can. If you want more information on ESG and the Great Reset and the World Economic Forum and stakeholder capitalism, please check out other videos we have done on Stopping Socialism TV. Check out the material we've published on heartland.org or read The Great Reset by Glenn Beck, Justin Haskins, and most importantly, main contributor Donald Kendall. Chris, thoughts on this the European Union ESG scheme going down in flames, going up like an electric vehicle? What do you say about it?
I was pleasantly surprised to see that Germany and Finland and a couple other countries opposed this bill. I think that the European Union might be on the verge of cracking under the pressure that you can't have all these different countries agreeing on things that benefit some and don't benefit others. And, you know, like an industrial powerhouse like Germany would have to, you know, subsidize and help like other. So there's all sorts of problems that are happening within the EU. I think this also goes back to 2016 with Brexit. And I think that it would be very beneficial for European countries if they dissolved the EU and they went about their own they went on their own way and that they retained or, you know, re-attained their sovereignty, because I think that right now the EU is doomed. And I would much rather have European countries working with the United States on an individual basis. I'd rather have, you know, trade alliances, you know, with countries on a per country basis rather than these giant blocks. I think that it would just be beneficial for all parties, because then you'd also have a lot of competition in the EU, and you could have Germany and Spain and Greece and other countries competing, you know, for trade agreements and such.
Chris Talgo advocating for Brexit 6.0. Jim, thoughts on this? I was pretty fatalist on this. I figured this was just going to pass without even a whimper in the European Union. And then we would have to just deal with the repercussions across the ocean, see what happens. But then it all went up in flames. What are your thoughts on this? How surprised were you?
I guess I was a little surprised, but I'm like you. I keep waiting for that hand to pop out of the grave. You know, I keep waiting for Jason to sit up, you know, in fuzzy, out of focus in the back of the room and grab the knife again. I'll believe it when it's dead. Right. I'll believe it actually when they start, when there are public programs, or I should say, rallies in the streets, and that the politicians in the EU actually come out and actively say that ESG is bad, that these things are crushing our economy, they're killing freedom. Because in general, I don't think most members of the European Parliament give. I want to not swear. They don't care too much about liberty, free markets, and representing the people in a proper way. So to me, You know, the cynic in me says it's a tactical retreat and they'll be back any second. But, you know,
Jim,
I want to be wrong.
Do you think the massive farmer protests in countries like Germany and the Netherlands has possibly influenced some of those leaders? Because we've seen some pretty big, you know, protests in yeah. European countries recently.
I hope so. I hope okay. so. I guess we'll have to keep an eye on it and see if that's the case. I mean, if this if the farmer movement is actually making the command and controllers in Europe a little bit hesitant, if not scared, about going forward with their long-held plans, then yay. Yeah. I'd like to see more evidence that that's the case and then that they would really back off, but we'll see.
Even those yellow vest protests in France a couple of years ago, those were related, I think, to energy prices, right?
They were. But yeah, yet all this stuff still kept moving forward. So,
right,
you know, we'll see.
But it seems like it's like the trajectory has slowed down. So it seems like the European Union and these you know, countries, you know, leaders are at least understanding that the people don't want this. And, you know, yeah, the bottom line is they're accountable to those people at the voting booth eventually.
Yeah, and yeah, like I said, people are kind of observing a bit of a rightward swing in Europe in terms of political ideology. So maybe this is a little bit of a retreat for some of those people that are trying to remain in power and not upset the apple cart too much. But yes, that will do it for Davos Watch. That'll do it for the In the Tank podcast for this week. I want to thank all of you for tuning in to the episode. Please tune in every week for a new episode. Those audio-only listeners, please leave a review for us on iTunes. That'd be greatly appreciated. You could also join us Thursdays at noon Central Time, where we are live streaming on Facebook and YouTube and X and Rumble. You can join the conversation, throw your comments and questions in the chat. Maybe we'll show your comments on the screen. Maybe we'll address your questions on the fly. Support the show with the super chat functionality we have enabled if you want to guarantee your comment or question is read on air. Or you could help us out just by hitting that like button, sharing this content, subscribing if you haven't already, or leaving a comment under the video. All helps break through those big tech algorithms that prevent content like this from being shown to more people. If you'd like, you can follow us on X at In the Tank Pod, or you can send us your comments, suggestions, or questions to the show by emailing us at inthetankpodcast@gmail.com. Jim Lakely, where can the fine people find you? He's muted.
I bet he's gonna say.
You can find me muted at Jay Lakely on Twitter, at Heartland Inst on X, and always visit heartland.org.
Fantastic. And Chris Talgo, what do you have to pitch today?
Well, I am at the Heartland headquarters in Mountain Heights, Illinois. So anyone in the area, please come and look at our beautiful headquarters and come visit our awesome offices. We are actually going to have an event March 21st and April 3rd. So go to heartland.org, check that out. And if you are in the area, please do come by because Heartland events are great.
Way to pitch our Heartland stuff. And also, we got more Heartland content coming to you tomorrow at noon Central Time with the Climate Realism Show. Check that out. All right. Thank you all for tuning in. We will talk to you next week.